to our deep dive. We're unpacking a fascinating technical paper by R. Cornell and HKDH Padacia on the decarburization of steel.
Which is a bit of a mouthful, but it really challenges our basic intuition about solid objects.
It really does.
Because what they reveal is that steel is incredibly vulnerable under the right conditions.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a journey into the hidden microscopic world of metallurgy and diffusion.
Right.
We're looking at the invisible, relentless movement of atoms that engineers basically have to constantly battle.
And it is a battle that affects you every day, whether you realize it or not. Like
yeah.
The safety of the car you drive or the building you work in, it relies on understanding this invisible theft.
Mm-hmm.
But before we can grasp how a solid piece of metal can just lose its ingredients to the air, we first have to talk about why we are baking steel in the first place.
Yeah, the whole concept of heat treatment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because steel is not just one thing, right? It is incredibly versatile.
Mm.
But to unlock all those different strengths and flexibilities, you have to heat it up.
Right. The sources refer to heating the metal into the austenite phase field.
Which sounds very sci-fi.
It does, yeah. But to visualize what that actually means, just imagine the atoms in a piece of room temperature steel. They're packed tightly together in a very specific rigid pattern.
Okay.
But when you heat that steel up to anywhere from, say, 800 to 1200 degrees Celsius, depending on its chemical makeup, that internal structure fundamentally changes.
So the iron atoms literally rearrange themselves.
Exactly. They shift into a new crystal structure, which is what we call austenite. And this new arrangement creates microscopic gaps, which basically allows the carbon atoms inside to move around more freely.
I like to think of it like opening up a crowded dance floor so the guests can finally mingle.
That's a great way to put it. You want that new arrangement so you can lock in specific structural properties when it cools back down.
Right. And the scale of this baking process is just mind-boggling. We aren't just talking about, you know, a scientist with tweezers in a lab.
No, not at all.
Commercial heat treatments happen in everything from small electrical resistance furnaces the size of a microwave all the way up to these massive natural gas-fired furnaces.
Oh, yeah. Some of those are the size of a moderately sized building.
Right. Just holding thousands of tons of steel at once.
Which introduces a massive problem.
Because of the air.
Yes. Whether it is a microwave-sized electric box or a building-sized gas cavern, the atmosphere inside that furnace inevitably contains oxygen. And here is where we get to the core mechanism of the theft the authors describe, which is chemical potential.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second. If I am baking a cake, I am putting it in the oven to change its internal texture, right? I want it to be fluffy.
Sure.
But imagine if the air inside your oven was so desperately dry that it actively sucked the sugar right out of the cake's crust while it was baking.
Oh, wow.
Like the cake might look totally fine on the outside, but the crust would taste like cardboard.
That is a brilliant way to picture it, honestly. The air inside the furnace is essentially, well, hungry for carbon.
Hungry air.
Right. In thermodynamics, we say the chemical potential of carbon in that hot furnace air is lower than the chemical potential of the carbon locked inside the steel.
And nature hates that kind of imbalance.
Nature absolutely abhors an imbalance like that. It
yeah.
wants equilibrium. So because the pulling force of the air is stronger, the carbon atoms are quite literally drawn out of the solid steel.
And just released into the surrounding atmosphere.
Exactly. This invisible, continuous drain of carbon. That is the process known as decarburization.
But, I mean, if this invisible theft is happening in every furnace, how deep does the damage actually go?
That's the big question.
Right. Are we talking about a microscopic scratch on the surface? Or is the whole beam ruined? Because you can't exactly see carbon atoms flying through the air.
No, you can't. And to answer that, the authors of the paper performed a microscopic autopsy on a very specific piece of steel.
Right. The sample they called M0.
M0, yes. Which is basically an iron alloy with about 0.8% carbon by weight.
So they take this sample, they put it in an electric furnace with zero protection, and they just blasted it 1200 degrees Celsius for 2 solid hours.
Yep. Then they let it cool slowly back to room temperature. But here's the thing. You still can't just look at the piece of metal with your naked eye and see what happened.
You can't even just stick it under a standard microscope.
Right. No, because if you cut a piece of steel in half, the saw blade smears the metal. It leaves this shiny, deformed surface that completely hides the actual atomic structure underneath.
So to actually see this damage, the authors had to practically perform surgery on the steel.
They really did.
Like, the sources say they grind it down flat with silicon carbide paper, polish it with microscopic diamond paste until it has a flawless mirror finish,
mm-hmm.
and then they wash it with a 2% nitrile solution, which is a mix of nitric acid and methanol, for exactly 20 seconds.
Right.
I mean, wait, why such an agonizingly specific preparation just to look at the metal?
Well, the acid is the secret key here. It's a process called etching.
Etching?
Yeah. When you apply that nitric acid mixture, it eats away at the different microscopic structures of the steel at slightly different rates.
Oh, I see.
So the softer parts might dissolve a bit faster than the harder parts, and this creates a topographical map.
Like a landscape of microscopic hills and valleys.
Exactly. And that landscape reflects light differently. Only then, under a powerful microscope, can you see the full extent of the carbon drain.
And the sources guide us through exactly what that etched cross-section looks like. It is basically a gradient of destruction.
It really is.
Let's walk through those layers, starting from the free surface, the very outer crust of our baked cake.
Okay.
According to the images, it is almost completely denuded of carbon. The sugar is entirely gone.
Right. And because the carbon has fled from the surface, the oxygen from the furnace doesn't just pack up and leave.
No, it sticks around.
It begins to attack the iron itself. The authors note that this oxidation penetrates the prior austenite grain boundaries.
Let's pause on that. Why the grain boundaries? Like, what makes them the weak point?
Well, think of a piece of steel not as one giant continuous crystal, but as millions of microscopic crystals packed tightly together.
Okay, like a mosaic.
Yeah, like a mosaic. The grain boundaries are the seams where those different crystals meet. And because the crystal lattices don't perfectly align at those seams, they are structurally messy.
Oh, so they don't fit perfectly.
Right. The authors call them high-energy sites. They are essentially tiny fault lines or microscopic hallways that make it much easier for invading oxygen atoms to travel down and tear the structure apart.
So the oxygen is just wedging itself into the microscopic cracks between the crystals.
Exactly.
And because all the carbon is gone from this outer layer, the metal physically transforms. The authors say a phase called ferrite nucleates at these boundaries.
Yes.
What exactly is ferrite in this context?
Ferrite is basically pure iron. Because there is no carbon left to give the steel its characteristic hardness, the iron reverts to the soft, light etching structure.
Wow.
So at the very surface, you have layers of this soft, pure iron mixed with heavily oxidized, damaged seams.
I mean, if this was a gear in a machine, this outer layer would be completely useless.
Completely. It would fail almost immediately under stress.
That is wild. But that is just the outer shell. As we move slightly inward, deeper into the metal, the visual changes. We enter this intermediate zone. The text describes it as looking like a low-carbon steel on the side closer to the surface and a higher-carbon steel as you move toward the center.
Because you are witnessing the exact gradient of the carbon theft. You are seeing the transition in real time. Well, frozen in time.
Right.
In this middle zone, the structures get incredibly complex. The pure, soft, allotriomorphic ferrite starts to decrease.
Bend in its place.
You see the emergence of dark etching regions, which are mixtures of widmanstätten ferrite and perlite.
Okay, those names sound like we were exploring an alien landscape.
What?
Widmanstätten ferrite, perlite. What are we actually looking at here?
They do sound alien, and honestly, under a microscope, they look alien too.
I bet.
As the carbon concentration slowly increases the deeper you go, the steel tries to accommodate it. Perlite, for instance, is a very strong, tough microstructure.
What does it look like?
It actually looks like a fingerprint or microscopic plywood. It's these alternating thin layers of soft ferrite and a hard, carbon-rich compound called cementite.
Oh, so it's tough and resilient.
Exactly.
And the widmanstätten ferrite.
That is a specific jagged formation. Instead of smooth layers, it forms in sharp, needle-like or plate-like structures that just shoot through the metal.
Like little spikes.
Yeah. It happens because the steel is cooling down and the remaining carbon is frantically trying to organize itself. But what is truly remarkable is that metallurgists don't just look at these shapes and guess.
Yeah.
They can predict the exact ratio of the soft, jagged ferrite to the tough, layered perlite using something called the lever rule.
Okay, wait. How does a lever apply to microscopic crystals?
It works exactly like a seesaw on a playground.
Okay.
And if you know the eutectoid temperature and you look at the iron-carbon phase diagram, which is essentially the master map of how a snail behaves, you can calculate the exact balance.
So the carbon is the fulcrum.
Yes. The amount of carbon left in that specific microscopic zone acts as the fulcrum of the seesaw. It tells the engineer precisely how much soft ferrite will balance out the hard perlite.
That is literally a mathematical map of the damage.
It is.
So finally, if we keep pushing deeper past the jagged needles and the alternating layers, we reach the interior of the steel.
Right, the core.
And this deep core is completely unaffected by the 2 hours in the 1200-degree furnace. The sources note this interior is fully pyrolytic.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a fascinating detail here. They classify this original M0 steel as hypotectoid.
That is a crucial baseline.
Why?
When we say hypotectoid, we are referring to the perfect chemical balance. A perfectly eutectoid steel has just the right amount of carbon, around 0.76%, so that when it cools, it turns into 100% of that tough, layered perlite.
But our M0 sample was roughly 0.8% carbon.
Actually, the fact that they observed a tiny bit of soft ferrite, even in the deepest, unaffected interior, means the true, original composition of their specific piece of metal was just slightly below that perfect balance point.
Ah, I see.
It is a tiny detail, but for scientists trying to measure exactly how much carbon vanished from the surface, establishing that precise baseline of the unaffected core is absolutely mandatory.
That makes sense. Seeing these physical layers from the ruined, soft, pure iron on the outside, through the jagged intermediate zone, down to the tough, layered core, it really makes you realize this is a physical migration of atoms.
It's a journey.
Which brings us to the question of speed. If this theft is happening, how fast is the clock ticking? Because the sources present a really fascinating scenario to calculate this.
They do. They set up a practical engineering problem. We aren't just looking at pictures anymore. We are predicting failure.
Let's look at the scenario. They take a piece of steel that starts with 0.7% carbon throughout. They put it in a furnace 1200 Kelvin. The hungry atmosphere immediately strips the very surface down to a constant 0.1% carbon.
Mm-hmm.
The question they pose is, how long does it take for this severe carbon loss to penetrate deep into the metal? Specifically, how long until the carbon drops to a dangerously low level, 0.4%, at a depth of 2.5 millimeters.
Now, 2.5 millimeters might not sound like much, but if that is the protective outer layer of a load-bearing bolt or an engine turbine, a loss of hardness at that depth is catastrophic.
Right, so how do they figure it out?
The authors run the calculation using the diffusion coefficient of carbon in austenite, which is basically 3 × 10⁻¹⁰ square meters per second.
That is incredibly small.
It is. It's essentially the microscopic speed limit for how fast these atoms can move through the iron lattice.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
The result they get using their primary mathematical model, the error function solution, is around 16.7 hours, or, 6 × 10⁴ seconds.
Nearly 17 hours of constant blistering heat just for the carbon depletion to reach that specific 2.5 millimeter depth.
Wait, I need to push back on this.
Okay, go ahead.
17 hours seems incredibly slow. I mean, if we are talking about a furnace at 1200 Kelvin, that is blindingly hot. The metal is glowing.
Oh, absolutely glowing.
At that temperature, aren't the atoms just vibrating violently and bouncing around at massive speeds? If they were moving that fast, why does it take nearly an entire day for the carbon to travel a couple of millimeters?
This raises an important question, and it gets to the heart of what diffusion actually is. You are thinking about the heat causing the atoms to bounce around randomly.
Yeah, exactly.
The authors actually address this. If you use a standard Mathematica formula for a random walk, which is, x is approximately equal to the square root of d times t, that's how you calculate aimless random movement.
And what happens if you use that?
You get a completely different, much shorter time frame.
So why is the random walk estimate formula wrong here?
Because the carbon atoms in our steel are not wandering aimlessly. A random walk is like putting a blindfolded person in the middle of a massive, empty football field and telling them to take one step in a completely random direction every second.
They'll eventually wander away from the center.
Right, they will, but their path is chaotic and incredibly inefficient.
But inside the steel, there is a specific pulling force.
Yes. The chemical potential we talked about earlier. The surface has been stripped down to 0.1% carbon, while the deep interior is still sitting at 0.7%.
Right. So there's a slope.
Exactly. This creates a steep slope, a concentration gradient. The carbon atoms are actively moving down that gradient toward the surface to try and satisfy the hungry atmosphere.
So it isn't a blindfolded person in an empty field.
No, it is more like a dense crowd of people in a narrow hallway, and someone just opened the exit doors at one end. Everyone is being driven in a particular direction.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
But because they are packed inside that dense iron crystal lattice, they have to squeeze past other atoms, wait for gaps to open up, and fight their way toward the surface.
Ah.
It is a driven, directional process, but it is bottlenecked by the physical structure of the metal itself. That directional drive changes the mathematical reality entirely.
Which is why they use that complex error function equation instead of the random walk.
Exactly. To find the true, much slower time of 17 hours.
So what does this all mean for you? I mean, we've explored building-sized furnaces, we've mapped out microscopic fault lines, and we've calculated the speed of atoms squeezing through a crowded hallway.
Right.
But how does this translate to the real world? Because if you are an engineer relying on steel for strength, you simply cannot afford for your outer layers to quietly turn into soft, weak ferrite.
The implications are massive. Think about a steel gear inside a massive industrial machine.
Right.
If that gear was heat treated and suffered unknown decarburization, the outer teeth of that gear are physically softer than the manufacturer intended.
Which means they wear down.
Over time, those teeth will wear down faster than the rest of the machine. They might warp, or under sudden stress, they might just shear off completely.
Causing a catastrophic mechanical failure.
Exactly. You have to know this invisible leak is happening so you can stop it.
And the sources outline exactly how engineers fight back and stop the leak. If the core problem is the hungry oxygen and the chemical potential in the furnace air, the solution is to cut off the interaction entirely. The text provides a few very practical physical interventions.
The most common industrial solution for high-value components is to literally change the air. You perform the heat treatment in an inert
So
atmosphere.
you just remove the oxygen.
You literally pump out the oxygen and replace it with a gas like argon or nitrogen. These are gases that have no chemical desire to steal carbon.
But if you have a furnace the size of a building, filling it with pure argon might not be cost-effective or even possible,
Oh,
right?
definitely not. It's hugely expensive.
So the authors note that if you can't control the room, you protect the component itself. You can wrap the piece of steel tightly in stainless steel foil before it goes into the fire.
It is a brilliant low-tech solution.
Just wrap it like a baked potato.
Basically, yeah. Because stainless steel has a different chemical composition, it resists oxidation and doesn't participate in the same carbon exchange.
Oh, interesting.
Wrapping the vulnerable part is like putting a heavy-duty spacesuit on it. The foil acts as a physical wall, preserving the carbon gradient inside the vulnerable piece.
Like wrapping that potato in foil before throwing it in the campfire so it doesn't turn to pure ash.
Exactly.
And finally, if wrapping isn't an option, the text mentions you can literally paint the component with a specific isolating paint.
Right.
And all of these methods, the inert gas, the foil, the paint, they do the exact same thing mechanically, don't they?
Yeah, they act as a physical barrier to block the chemical potential imbalance, just preventing the hungry air from ever touching the steel. It really highlights just how delicate the whole operation is. We have to go to incredible lengths to force steel to remain steel when it gets hot.
So to bring it all together, our journey today took us from the massive scale of industrial baking ovens down to the microscopic autopsy of sample M0. We watched as oxygen invaded the fault lines of the grain boundaries, leaving behind layers of soft, pure iron and jagged alien-looking crystals.
It's quite a visual.
And we explored the ticking clock of diffusion, learning why atoms driven by a chemical gradient behave more like a crowd pushing toward an exit than people wandering randomly in a field.
It really forces you to completely rethink what a solid material actually is.
It does.
And I'd like to leave you with a final thought to mull over, building on everything we have unpacked today.
Go for it.
The next time you walk past a massive steel suspension bridge, or look up at a towering skyscraper holding its own against the wind, consider that the solid metal in front of you is not a frozen static object.
It only looks permanent to us because of the temperature.
Exactly. At an atomic level, under the right conditions, its very chemical identity is restless. It is constantly trying to negotiate and exchange its fundamental elements with the invisible air surrounding it.
That is wild to think about.
It is less like a permanent rock and more like a very slow-moving liquid trapped in an incredibly delicate, invisible balance with the sky.